What interest might a 1956 documentary, short subject, about a library hold today for the historically minded spectator? What assumptions concerning the status of film as document and text might be in order? How might such assumptions take on complexity when the subject of the film is a national institution of record whose mission is to amass, classify, and conserve a variety of printed materials and other objects? These questions locate my remarks on Alain René's 1956 All the World's Memory, Toute la mémoire du monde, within a book-length work in progress centered on 12 to 15 documentaries produced in France between 1945 and 1967. Making Waves, the title of this project and of my talk this evening, explores these documentaries in conjunction with the emergence and evolution of the French New Wave, whose impact on film production and aesthetics between 1959 and 1968 was arguably worldwide. A second and equally important sense of the title invokes efforts by these filmmakers, the filmmakers whose works comprise my corpus, to mobilize modes and practices of documentary filmmaking towards social missions ranging from critique and consciousness raising to militancy. Making Waves in this latter sense explores how these films promote change and/or action through forms of address directed toward target or real spectators. Documentaries, also known as nonfiction films, are generally understood as a cinematic means of conveying factual information, often, but certainly not always, in a direct and objective manner. Michael Renoff writes that that documentaries tend to be reality-driven because the stories they tell and show derive more directly from real life than from invention. The distinction holds despite the fact that documentaries often display many elements of narrative form and visual style to be found in so-called fiction films. Renoff lists four sets of documentary practices under headings of 1. Recording, revealing, or preserving, 2. Analyzing or questioning, 3. Advocating or persuading, and 4. Expressing. He grounds these practices on a fundamental desire to know. He aligns with a drive to master one's life and environs. In the end, my preference is to define documentary film less as a distinct genre than as an idea, function, or value, present to some degree in all films as a product of intention and context. In the graduate seminar I'm teaching this quarter, I've also talked about documentary as a certain kind of look, a certain kind of glance. The Making Waves project explores how, in what ways and to what extent, documentaries in my corpus contribute to understanding a period in France marked by attempts to import an American-style model of modernization based on economic expansion and by a divisive lack of consensus concerning the future of overseas territories occupied by France as colonies or protectorates. Taking these two major phenomena of the 4th and early 5th century, 4th and early 5th French republics into account, my analyses mean to emulate Clifford Geertz's notion of a thick description attentive to the cultural specificity of the films under study. In this sense, I consider these films less as transparent documents allowing direct and unquestioned access to the period than as complex objects whose analysis opens onto a convergence of practices and institutions linked to social and political issues that defined France between 1945 and 1967. Why film and why documentaries? One claim to be tested throughout Making Waves is the assertion that early post-war films such as All the World's Memory responded to an imperative for documented understanding to which the medium of motion pictures was uniquely suited. the aptness of film to meet this imperative derived first from technology. The illusion of motion produced on celluloid film running 24 frames per second often approximated measurable duration understood as clock time. Moreover, it regularly did so by projected images whose larger-than-life scale simulated an immediacy of experience that bordered on the subjective. In his 1929 silent documentary, Man with a Movie Camera, the filmmaker Dziga Vertov, born Denis Abramovich Kaufman, varied the duration of individual shots and used kaleidoscopic effects to convey sensations of speed associated with daily life in an urban setting increasingly under the sway of machines. Between approximately 1890 and 1940, this technological dimension of film as medium was in line with European and American practices in literature and the arts that explored the heightened speed and density of experience. Writing in 1953, the film critic André Bazin characterized the aptness of film from another perspective when he noted the prevalence of objective reporting following World War II. Quote, "Today the public demands that what it sees shall be believable, a faith that can be tested by the other media of information, namely radio, books, and the daily press." End of quote. Bazin was writing in this case about Thor Heyerdahl's exploration film Kon-Tiki, but this post-war call for believability was also a response to World War II genocide and mass violence with which France and other combatant nations had not yet fully come to terms. It is this conjuncture of technology and historical context that I mean to explore in my consideration of All the World's Memory as a film of early post-war France. 50 years ago this coming May, Alain René's Hiroshima Mon Amour helped to transform the French New Wave into an international phenomenon when it won the 1959 International Critics Award at the Cannes Film Festival. Hiroshima was the first of 16 feature films René has directed to date, but it was not at all his first film. Between 1936 and 1958, he undertook close to 24 projects, some of which were unreleased and others lost. Among 8 documentaries René completed between 1948 and 1958, his 1955 short subject, Night and Fog, remains an object of scrutiny and debate. Night and Fog in English is the translation of Nacht und Nebel from German, and that was the name of a directive that the Nazis put out in December 1941 to make enemies of the Third Reich disappear into the night as if into fog. The reference, though, comes from Wagner and from the Nibelungen opera Das Rheingold. Much of Night and Fog's emotional impact derived from René's skills as a film editor adept at aligning shots and sequences for maximal effect. Period footage and black and white photographs of deportations and of concentration camps alternated with mainly color sequences filmed at the sites of the former camps a decade later. This mix of images was set against a voiceover commentary by former deportee Jean Cayrol and a musical score by political exile Hans Eisler. Debated at the time of the film's release were its implication of the Vichy government's complicity in the deportation of detainees in France to concentration camps east of the Rhine, and allegations that the film inadequately identified the primary deportees and concentration camp inhabitants seen in the film as Jews. The ongoing attention devoted to Hiroshima and to Night and Fog has supported received opinion concerning René's films through the mid-1960s in the film called The War is Over, La Guerre est Finie, as earnest meditations on individual and collective trauma often linked to wartime violence. In Hiroshima, these two kinds of trauma were embodied in the character of a French woman played by Emmanuelle Riva, who has a brief affair with a Japanese man whom she meets while she is in Hiroshima to act in a film on the atomic bombing that took place there in August 1945. Of more than passing interest was a sequence early in the film in the format of a pseudo-documentary that contextualized the opening dialogue between the film's two characters. The sequence featured female victims of the 1945 bombing whose direct gaze into the camera addressed spectators in a gesture of absolute witnessing and accusation. Like many documentaries, All the World's Memory was a commissioned film initiated in response to a request. In this instance, the request originated at the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs as an idea for a documentary about the Bibliothèque Nationale, the French National Library on the Rue de Richelieu in central Paris. The title was conceived as part of a series called The Encyclopedia of Paris with the government-run radio and television services, Radio et Télévision Française, listed as co-producer. The nature of this commission discloses assumptions concerning genre and format, documentary, reportage, educational visit, as well as sponsorship, national library, national radio, and television services. These assumptions, in turn, created expectations on the part of spectators concerning how they might understand what they were about to see. They also linked the film's institutional origins to events that had set Alain René at odds with the state-run National Center of Cinematography in 1953, three years earlier, after it had refused to grant a certificate required for commercial release to Statues Also Die, a 30-minute documentary on African art on display in European museums that René and Chris Marker had made at the request of the Présence Africaine journal and publishing house in Paris. It's plausible to align the request from the French Foreign Ministry with other commissions René had received from government and private sponsors since 1948. The request might also have been a kind of safety valve in the sense of a minor project allowing René to move beyond the role of bad boy filmmaker, cinéaste provocateur, he had assumed in the wake of controversies generated first by Statues Also Die and subsequently by Night and Fog, which French government officials had withdrawn from official entry in the 1955 Cannes Film Festival when they decided the film might provoke protests from West Germany. A third possibility was that René accepted the commission in order to appropriate or perhaps even hijack it to ends other than those its sponsors had in mind. This last possibility, which I favor, was based on irresolution surrounding Statues Also Die that had set René and Marker at odds first with government censors and later even with colleagues at Présence Africaine and the Tadier Production Company, who had sought to release an edited version of the film shortened by a full third, from 30 minutes to 20 minutes. The resulting deadlock delayed commercial programming of Statues Also Die in its entirety until November 1968, a full 15 years after it was completed. The institutional continuities between All the World's Memory, Statues Also Die, and Night and Fog point to the close oversight exercised by government agencies to which all filmmaking in post-war France was subject. This oversight extended from censorship toward financing practices on which documentary and short subjects were especially dependent. An early disclosure of resistance to this oversight occurred in the opening credits of the film, in which the names of René and his chief cinematographer, Guylain Cloquet, appeared over three X's enclosed within parentheses. The X's referred to the Group of 30, Le Groupe des Trente, created in 1953 as a lobby group of filmmakers, producers, and others united to defend the short subject format defined as a film whose running time was less than 47 minutes and 30 seconds against proposed changes in government funding policies. René and Cloquet signed the group's manifesto, as did established figures of an older generation, such as Alexandre Astruc, Denise Belan, Pierre Bromberger, Jacques-Yves Cousteau, Georges Franju, Jean Mitry, Jean Palvé, Georges Rouquier, and Nicole Védresse. Within weeks, the group's numbers grew from 30 to 79. A first concern surrounds the place of All the World's Memory within the films René made immediately before and after it. Notable within this sequence was the French government's intervention concerning the two films that preceded it and the relative silence concerning the latter two, which remained more or less unknown. But rather than characterizing All the World's Memory as a break from its embattled predecessors, I see it as extending an engagement with issues of collective memory and institutional record René's previous films had addressed. A note of caution, my remarks on this sequence of documentary shorts are intended less to locate them primarily within René's evolution as a filmmaker than to align them in ways that discloses continuities and differences they might not disclose when approached individually or under the primary category of authorial corpus. Instead, I mean to approach these documentaries as raising questions concerning aspects of modernization in the wake of a World War II occupation with which many in France had not yet fully come to terms. Correspondence among individuals at the French Foreign Ministry, the Nationalized Radio and Television Agency, and the Bibliothèque Nationale referred to an initial synopsis in three parts describing the library's physical and organizational structure, its contents in six nominal collections, and its operations that stored, conserved, and displayed holdings the film characterized as treasures, trésors. A February 5, 1955 memorandum addressed to the BN's director, Julien Quint, listed some factual errors and faulted a verbal tone more appropriate to advertising than to a major government agency, un grand organisme français. The author of the memorandum concluded that a viable film would be possible only if someone acting in the name and interests of the library were authorized to coordinate and to oversee a well-structured project. Some 2 months after the initial synopsis was dropped in October 1955, a follow-up memo from another library administrator described a visit by Pierre Bromberger, head of the Film de la Pléiade production company, whose willingness to assume part of the film's financing led to René's appointment as its director. Soon after his appointment, this appointment led in turn to two synopses by Remo Forlani, whom René had met a decade earlier in Paris when both were working with an activist group of left-wing Catholics, Travail et Culture, Work and Culture, to which André Bazin also belonged. Forlani's first synopsis set forth a utopian vision of the Bibliothèque Nationale as the site of an archive that promoted knowledge in the form of a universal memory. To this end, Forlani proposed that some sequences be shot as in a futuristic science fiction film, others without commentary as in a silent film, and yet others whose perspectives from above and below Forlani described as recalling U.S. Sing Sing prison movies. Perhaps he and René were thinking of George W. Hill's The Big House, 1930, starring Wallace Beery. The first synopsis also included the following passage anticipating the type of rapid access that electronics and digitization have since facilitated. Here's a quote. "Let's imagine a giant machine, a robot, capable of providing answers to every kind of question as easily as the machines in the metro stations that tell you instantly how much you weigh. With the help of television, it may be possible one day, simply by turning a knob, to call up on a screen all the images and words resuming human knowledge. One can imagine that one day all the masterpieces of culture will be linked together so that a continuous reading and a permanent access to all memories will be possible. The world's memory will exist as a reality, making the Bibliothèque Nationale not simply a storehouse, a magasin, but a museum or archive of civilization in its various written expressions. Truly, all the world's memory. End of quote. A second scenario by Forlani characterized this utopian vision in somewhat different terms. There is a secret, quote, concerning memory in the National Library, one of happiness or of peace. These texts exist, but for the moment, the library's readers fail to understand the secret. End of quote. René disclosed part of this secret during a day in the life sequence, showing how the Bibliothèque Nationale ensured the continuous growth of its collections. Three uniformed men were seen carrying sacks through an inner courtyard and down a staircase. A brief nod to Arthur Freed and Nacio Herb Brown singing in the rain in Maurice Jarre's musical score conveyed a light touch, as though the three workers were on the set of a Hollywood musical. Approximately 4 minutes of the film, from 9 minutes 40 seconds to 13 minutes 20 seconds, followed a new acquisition being received, stamped, cataloged, and shelved for eventual retrieval and consultation. The sequence, which evoked a strong sense of incarceration, picked up on tracking shots of the BN's dome and exterior early in the film that recalled the architecture of camp watchtowers seen in Night and Fog a year earlier. These visual parallels were strengthened by an explicit remark at 4 minutes 27 seconds asserting that in Paris, words are imprisoned at the Bibliothèque Nationale, which was perhaps a way of saying that the Bibliothèque Nationale was a non-circulating library. René had shown in Night and Fog how tattoos and ledger entries had reduced concentration camp prisoners to numbered objects. All the world's memory treated books as though they were human. Writing in 1957, Jacques Doniol-Valcoz asked whether René had intentionally or maybe even involuntarily completed a film whose sense of stifling enclosure extended an obsession with the concentration camp universe, an univers concentrationnaire, from one film to the next. And here's a quote from Doniol-Valcoz's article. His film tells the story of a land where all the character books are automatically imprisoned as soon as they are born. Release thereafter is impossible. What is possible is to visit the prisoner after completing written forms that persuade the authorities you won't try to help the prisoner escape. End of quote. A telling detail of what René was trying to do in the sequence was the fact that the book being processed was not a real book, but a non-existent title in the real Petite Planète series, Petite Planète, Little Planet, series of travel guides edited at the Édition du Seuil publishing house by René's longtime collaborator, Chris Marker. Physical elements of the non-existent title included a cover photo of the Italian actress Lucia Bosé and an ersatz table of contents whose chapter titles included possible references to André Breton's Daybreak, the writer H.G. Wells, the journalist Jean-Marie Domenac, the filmmaker Agnès Varda, and finally, Alfred Hitchcock's film, The 39 Steps. The phony book was more than an inside joke. Much like shots featuring comic strip characters Mandrake the Magician and Dick Tracy, and another featuring the fictional pulp detective Harry Dixon. Inserted elsewhere in the film, it expressed René's lifelong interest in mass-market print cultures. The inclusion of these materials also raised more serious questions concerning the status of these materials among the BN's collections, among the treasures. In line with the interwar filmmaker Jean Vigo's vision of a documented point of view, these details expressed René's personal take on the BN and its collections as a subtle way of questioning the vision of the library as a repository of national treasures the French Foreign Ministry had presumably intended to convey when it commissioned the film. A chilling detail in my characterization of All the World's Memory as an extension of Night and Fog occurred during the film's final minute. After a tracking shot along tables in the main reading room stopped on a dark corner between two bookcases to reveal a barely visible figure whose uniform and cap with the letters BN identified him as a library guard. A close-up on the figure suggested that the previous shot was not inadvertent. The absence of camera movement notations in transcriptions of the commentary to the film I have consulted provides no clear way to resolve the apparent discrepancy between what the voiceover narrator stated and what the film showed. This discrepancy, which heightened the potential for irony in the form of a mixed message, is of special note because the two shots of this uniformed figure of surveillance recalled the archival photograph in Night and Fog of a figure whose uniform and képi identified him as a guard at the French detention camp at Pithiviers. This photograph was the image that government officials had wanted removed from Night and Fog because it implied that the Vichy government had been complicit with German-led deportations of detainees in France to concentration camps. In the end, René agreed to place a black bar over the side of the photograph so that the helmet, the KP, would not be seen, but everyone who sees it knows that the image was there. Aligning these two photographs supports my sense that the ideal of happiness, bonheur, to which the commentary of All the World's Memory referred as the library's secret, contained another secret embodied in the figure of institutional authority the film's final sequences showed as an agent of surveillance it kept almost, but certainly not completely, out of sight. The shadowy shots of the library guard also extended the film's opening sequence, shot in what appeared to be the library's basement. This sequence was composed of only five shots, four of which were tracking shots varying in length from 8 to 38 seconds. It makes for a very slow visual rhythm. The movie camera glided along a dimly lit underground space filled with piles of newspapers and overstuffed crates of books and other objects. The disorder underground was in sharp contrast to the strictly ordered spaces that were soon to be seen upstairs. What exactly might René have intended to show in the sequence? What role did the objects have among the library's collections? Were they to be understood as rejects, somehow unworthy of the treasures accessible for internal circulation above ground? In line with what René had shown a year earlier in Night and Fog, were they akin to the objects belonging to concentration camp inhabitants awaiting disposal elsewhere? Or were they, more pointedly, shots where These shots of objects in the BN's basement, meant to evoke images of the concentration camp's victims, seen in documentaries shot by soldiers who liberated the camp a decade earlier. Equally as unusual, equally as distressing in the opening sequence, was the visible presence of a movie camera, a microphone, and a carbon arc Klieg lamp that disclosed the filmmaking equipment René and his production team were using. The gesture was openly reflexive, as though to remind the spectator from the very start that what she or he was about to see was a film about the National Library rather than the library in itself. The abruptness with which these objects appeared on screen was heightened by Maurice Jarre's musical score and Georges Delerue's jarring orchestration of woodwinds, percussion instruments, and a celeste that conveyed a tone of otherworldliness. The two-minute sequence was framed by three sentences, the first of which stated that because they have short memories, men accumulate numerous devices to jog them. The closing sentences, the two closing sentences, asserted that men were frightened by the sight of these overstuffed compartments, frightened by these masses of writings, these heaps of words. So, in order to ensure their freedom, they constructed fortresses. And it's at that moment, just after fortresses, that we go to the top, to the dome, and then down into the library itself. Taken together, these two sequences, the sequence at the end with the surveillance guard and the sequence at the very beginning, which the spectator may well not know what to do with, taken together, these two sequences framed René's documented point of view of the library as an unfamiliar and disquieting space. In particular, the reference to fear ending the initial sequence supported statements by René that he had wanted to instill his film with a sense of mystery akin to that in the silent films by Louis Feuillade that featured the arch-villain Fantômas. This sense of the library as an unfamiliar and mysterious space was at a remove from Rainer Maria Rilke's characterization of the Bibliothèque Nationale 50 years earlier in his 1910 novel, The Notebooks of Malte Lauritz Brigge. Rilke wrote about the library as a haven where he could sit all day long reading poetry, among others, doing the same. A more recent characterization of note occurs in W.G. Sebald's novel, Austerlitz, in which the novel's title character tells the narrator that several years after conducting research on a daily basis at the library, he saw a short black and white film about it. When he noticed messages racing through the library by pneumatic tubes as along its nervous system, it struck him that the scholars working there and the library apparatus formed an immensely complex and evolving creature which had to be fed with myriads of words in order to bring forth even more words. A quote. I think that this film, which I saw only once, but which assumed ever more monstrous and fantastic dimensions in my imagination, was entitled Toute la mémoire du monde and was made by Alain René. Even before then, my mind often dwelt on the question of whether there in the reading room of the library I was on the islands of the blessed or, on the contrary, in a penal colony. End of quote. Some 20 pages later, Austerlitz tells the narrator of working at the new National Library, known as the Bibliothèque Nationale de France, on the left bank of the Seine, where birds occasionally killed themselves by flying into windows whose reflection of trees planted in the library's courtyard they had mistaken for real trees. And here's another quote from Austerlitz. Sitting at my place in the reading room, said Austerlitz, I thought at length about the way in which such unforeseen accidents, the fall of a single creature to its death when diverted from its natural path, or the recurrent symptoms of paralysis affecting the electronic data relieval system, relate to the Cartesian overall plan of the Bibliothèque Nationale, and I came to the conclusion that in any project we design and develop, the size and degree of complexity of the information and control systems inscribed in it are the crucial factors, so that the all-embracing and absolute perfection of the concept can in practice coincide, indeed ultimately must coincide, with its chronic dysfunction and constitutional instability. The passages from Austerlitz clarify how the historical moment depicted in all the world's memory opened onto a decade of post-war modernization that the film's genesis and release disclosed in conjunction with institutional controls on the part of government agencies. This is the sense in which Sebald's words state what René had already shown some 50 years earlier, namely that the idealized vision of universal knowledge entailed necessary control, surveillance, and exclusion that were best kept out of sight. 3 years before those of the hospitalized women seen in Hiroshima Mon Amour, the gaze of Lucia Bozzi disclosed, that is, showed, a secret dimension of state-controlled modernization in early post-war France that I take to hold ongoing interest for the historically minded spectators we should all strive to become. Thank you.